Good day. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now, here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, the secret societies, and the ancient Holy Grail mysteries. This show, the Guardians of the Holy Grail, was created by me to clear up many of the popular misconceptions that have been floating around the mainstream media regarding the secret societies and Holy Grail mysteries and the bloodline from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Through this show, I hope to set the record straight with hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as with testimonials from current and past members of the Initiatic Societies. I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and wisdom of the original Knights Templar, which over the centuries has been either lost or ignored. You can learn more about our Gnostic Temple organization, and you can sign our mailing list and receive our monthly e-news by visiting our website, which is www.gnostictemplars.org. You can also sign up for our 18-lesson Gnostic Templar e-course while you're there, and you can also become an associate member. We have a lot of goals in our organization. One of our long-term goals is to educate the world about the primal Gnostic alchemical path, which is the essence of all religions and essentially unites them as one. For hundreds of years, the secret societies around the globe have sought to replace religious dogma with this Gnostic alchemical tradition and thereby create a one-world spirituality. During today's show, if you have any questions for our guests, feel free to call our toll-free line at 866-472-5795. Before we get into the show, I'd like to mention about the tour I'll be leading this September that I'm excited about. September 20th to the 30th, I'll be leading a tour with my friend Nancy Safford, who's a High Priestess of the Mary Magdalene Mysteries, and also a Knight Templar. At this point, we're hoping we can get Henry Lincoln, who's living in the area where we're going to be having the tour, to talk to us, as well as Ben Hammett. Where we're going is southern France, in the area of Rennes-le-Château and Montségur, and northern Spain, the area of Montserrat. These are areas that are full of mysteries regarding the Holy Grail, the Knights Templar, Mary Magdalene, alchemy, Gnosis. If you know anything about that region of the Languedoc, you know that it's full of these heretical traditions and a lot of mysteries, a lot of mysteries. For some time now, ever since the publication of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, there's been a real focus on the Rennes-le-Château area, because supposedly a priest there named Berenger Saunier discovered a document that detailed the genealogy or the descendants from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So that has been an extremely important region for some time, and especially most recently when Ben Hammett discovered a cave there in the Rennes-le-Château region that has a mummy in it that he believes could be the mummy of Mary Magdalene. So there's a lot going on, and we're going to tap into, you know, as much as we can while we're there. We're also going to be there during the full moon and the fall equinox. So these are very high-powered times. We're going to be there doing a lot of rituals and talking extensively about the mysteries. If this is a tour you're called to go on, or this pilgrimage rather, it's more of a pilgrimage than a tour, but if you're called to be on this pilgrimage, go to this website, www.sacredsitesjourneys.com, and click on this tour to get the itinerary, the full itinerary, and a much broader explanation about what we're going to be doing on that tour. And you can also register for the tour on that website. So that's www.sacredsitesjourneys, all run together as one word, sacredsitesjourneys.com. Okay, today's show, we're going to be talking about a sacred temple that is at the root of many initiatic organizations. Well, this temple I'm talking about is Solomon's Temple, the edifice that we Templars were originally named after, and the temple that can be found at the heart of many or most of the Freemasonic rituals today. We will be discussing during the show many of the mysteries of Solomon's Temple and what made it one of the great wonders of the ancient world. My guest today is author Kevin Guest. Kevin's an engineer who's been studying churches and ancient temples since he was a young boy growing up in Rochester, England. At one point in his life, Kevin traveled throughout Australia, the Far East, India, Egypt, and throughout Europe while studying the sacred architecture, the temples and churches in those countries. Recently, he put all his vast experience and knowledge together in one volume and published it as The Secrets of Solomon's Temple, which today is considered by many to be the textbook on this subject of Solomon's temples. So greetings, Kevin. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and it's good evening from me and good afternoon from you, I guess.
Okay, good evening to you.
Good evening, Kevin. Yes, good evening.
So, as I understand it, where you grew up, there was also a Templar church nearby that you spent some time studying. Is that right?
Yes, it wasn't so much a Templar church. Rochester is a very, very old city here in the UK. It has its foundations going back even before Roman times, so that's getting on for 2,000 years old. And there is a wonderful cathedral and a wonderful old Norman church there. Now, there is a river that runs through the area, known as the River Medway, and in fact, perhaps many of your listeners will have heard of a place called Chatham, which was where there was a major British naval dockyard. And this town called Chatham and Rochester have over the years virtually merged to be one area. But this area, Chatham and Rochester, have been on this river called the Medway. Now, almost opposite the castle, on the opposite bank, is a very old building. And that building was a Knights Templar manor house. And the Templars had a very considerable holding of land in that area, which for a large period of time was used as a farm. In fact, today that area and some of the housing estates that there are in that area are still known as the Temple Farm Estates. And this old building still exists. It's now what's known as an English heritage site, and it's available for people to go into at various times of the year. And if ever you have any of your members who are passing through the UK here, it might be something that they'd like to add on their itinerary.
Well, certainly when we do pass through the UK, we want to visit as many of those kind of sites as we can. So we'll put that on the back burner for sure.
Yeah. Fine. Another interesting connection, I was just listening to your introduction there when you were talking about Montségur. And, of course, that takes us into Catholic country. And the area that I live here in the UK is an area close to a town called Lewes. Now, that was at the site of a great battle, the Battle of Lewes, at which Simon de Montfort happened to defeat the barons and therefore create the basis for building the sort of parliamentary system that we have today. But not only that, after that, he went off and he was involved in a siege at Rochester Castle, which ultimately he won by knocking down one of the corners of the castle. And when it was rebuilt, it has a slightly different form, which you can still see today. But then after that, he was the one who then left Rochester and went south to the Languedoc to deal with the Cathars, as he'd been asked to do. So you can see there's several connections there from an historical point of view.
Yeah, the infamous Simon de Montfort. He's not really popular amongst us Gnostics, as you can probably understand.
No, I don't think he's very popular anywhere.
Well, tell me, Kevin, what got you started on studying Solomon's Temple?
I guess really it came about. I mean, there was no one thing that sort of took me down that path, but I had become quite intrigued with the fact that there are three items in the Bible, in the Old Testament, which had dimensions to them. Of course, Noah's Ark, the Ark of the Covenant, and Simon's Temple, Solomon's Temple. And the thing that intrigued me most was that here we had, for example, Solomon's Temple was, in theory, built some 400 years before a lot of this information was actually documented on parchments, because that didn't. What we're told by archaeologists is that the actual writing down of this information that we see in the Old Testament didn't really start until about 600 BCE. So it's about 400 years after the temple was built. Now that, in turn, if we look at the Ark of the Covenant, you're looking at probably at least another 500 years out beyond that. And then when you get to Noah's Ark, possibly 1,000 years out beyond that. So we're looking at three items over a time span of perhaps 1,500 years. And yet these items are not only recorded in the Old Testament, but they've got all these an awful lot of detail, particularly with the dimensions. Now this means that to me that this information had to have been passed down from one generation to the next with some form of verbal tradition, probably stories that were told around campfires by Bedouin as they travelled around. But what was really intriguing is, why did they bother to put this information into these stories? It had to have been important and significant in some way. Otherwise, if you look at all that detail that there is surrounding, particularly Solomon's Temple, why would you bother to try and build all that into a story? You could make the story much more simple, much more dynamic, if you took out a lot of the detail. It had to have been there for a purpose. And that's really where some of my interest with all this started. And then as time went by and I started sort of to look at the numbers and play with the numbers, I began to realize that I was starting to look at something a little more than just sort of the idea that's painted by words on a page. And I went off to Egypt and had a trip up the Nile and went to the Temple of Abu Simbel and a lot of the temples that are along the Nile. And I was particularly struck by how many of these really ancient buildings are all based on orientation to the sun or to the moon or to various astronomical constellations. And I began to wonder whether or not there was some connection here, because when you go to the Temple of Abu Simbel in particular, and you go into one of the side rooms, side corridors, I should say, there is a wonderful wall engraving there, which apparently depicts the pharaoh, I can't think of his name now, Ramesses the Great, coming away from Jerusalem, having acquired all of their treasures. And I was very intrigued by that, because it raised in my mind the idea that perhaps he'd been to Jerusalem, obviously seen Solomon's Temple, because he just nicked all the treasures, and then went to this place called Abu Simbel, and there he built another temple, this time to himself and his wife, and built it on the sort of lines that he probably saw in Jerusalem, maybe having been fascinated by the way the sun works. Now, if you know anything about the Temple of Abu Simbel, you probably know that there are three characters at the back of a hall, and what happens is that at certain times of the year, the sun shines in through the main entrance door to the temple through a vast cavernous inner chamber to a small chamber right at the back, and then on specific days it illuminates each one of these three characters. And the penny sort of just, I wouldn't say dropped, but it was just something that said to me, I wonder if that's what Solomon's Temple did. And then when I started to sit down and draw it and do a little bit of astroarchaeology and looked at the way the sun worked, there did seem to be a connection.
So,
I've been
to Egypt myself, and now that I think about it, there definitely seems to be some similarities between the Egyptian temples and Solomon's Temple. Do you think that Solomon's Temple was actually modeled after one of the Egyptian temples?
There's a couple of very interesting books, one in particular by a guy called Dr. David Roll, who is a very, very well-known archaeologist in the UK. And in one of his books, he looks at the connections between some of the things going on in Egypt around the time that Solomon's Temple was supposedly built. And one of the things which is was a very strong connection is the fact that there is this guy who was regarded as an heretical pharaoh by the name of Akhenaten, who tried to break away from the religious forces which existed in Egypt at the time, which was praise of the god of the wind. And he particularly wanted to build a city and his temples based on the sun god. Now Akhenaten was alive, and he was going through this heretical phase, as it's been regarded, at about the same time that David was planning the Temple of Solomon based on what we're told in the Old Testament. Now, Egypt was a very big and a very powerful neighbor at that time. And really, I think we could say that Jerusalem was probably little more than a city-state under the pharaoh's tenure. And I cannot believe that David, in his planning, would not have been aware of what Akhenaten was up to, or indeed a lot of the planning that went into the ancient city that he originally built, which was built very much along the lines of being able to trap the rays of the sun at various times of the day. So my thoughts then say, well, if that's the case, then perhaps we again see this reflected in the design of Solomon's Temple. So what I did then was, again, sort of do some drawings. I built a couple of scale models. I set them up in my garage, and I tried sort of making all kind of replicating sort of what might have happened. And much to my amazement, I found everything worked practically in exactly the same way as I'd worked out on paper that it ought to theoretically. So I think that the answer, it's a long answer to your very short question, but I think, yes, there were things definitely going on in Egypt at around about that time, together, of course, all the knowledge that they had previously gained, and that David and Solomon could not possibly have been aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the pictures, the images of Solomon's temple that have been drawn up by artists, it looks very similar to a lot of those Egyptian temples. And what you find with the Egyptian temples is that at certain times that the sun would shine right down through the corridors, right through the two main pillars, right down through the corridors into what they call the naos, which was the little reliquary where they stationed the Neter, the god of that temple, and that would kind of correspond to the Holy of Holies of Solomon's temple. Exactly. And so perhaps it was created so that the sun would shine down through the court of Solomon's temple and illumine perhaps the Ark of the Covenant during one of the solstices.
Well, that's exactly sort of really the conclusion that I came to. But I stepped back and took yet one more view. Once I had come to the conclusion that exactly that kind of solar activity was happening, that it occurred to me that Solomon's temple may very well have been used as a calendar. Let me explain that. You will be well aware that the word gnosis means wisdom. And here we have, through David and Solomon, we have a tribe of people and possibly a country, an area, which seem to have been very stable. And based on what we're told about the treasures they had, they must have been extremely wealthy in their own way and in their own time. Now, if you go back to that time, the one thing which would have been extremely important were the forces of survival. And for survival, you're looking very much at the processes of the system of the seasons and the ability to be able to grow an abundance of food at the right times of the year in order to feed your populace, because if the populace is fed and is comfortable, they're going to be quiet. They're not going to be in rebellion. The country is going to grow in wealth because the chances are it may well have surpluses that it can sell to its neighbors, particularly if those neighbors happen to be in more arid areas and are not able to grow a lot of the produce that you've been able to do. And now to do that means you've got to have a means of being able to predict when you can sow certain crops, when is the right time to harvest, when is the time to be gathering seeds. And when you look at the descriptions again of the temple, it tells us that the inside walls of the temple were decorated with flowers and plants and trees. And I couldn't help believe that, or but believe that there were... These images may well have been used as what I would call almost a farming calendar. And indeed, when I drew out an image of the temple as an interpretation based on the facts that are mentioned in the Old Testament, and in particular looked at the windows which would have been in the upper area, I found that, again, using the principles of astroarchaeology, that sure enough, obviously, there will be illuminations on the, shall we say, the northern wall on the inside of the temple, and that as the sun progresses across the sky and with the seasons, so the area that would be illuminated on the wall would change. And that, to me, then said, I wonder whether or not then this isn't what I would call... A wisdom that's been handed down through the priesthood and through the elders of the tribe and is now being put into a more permanent position so that, you know, more and more people can see it and understanding. It's an agricultural calendar which would help to build the wealth of this nation. And sure enough, I found that certainly from my calculations and again from my models, that it had all that kind of capability. So it would have been an embodiment of ancient wisdom being formalized in much the same way as perhaps we might do an encyclopedia.
Well, one thing that interests me, Kevin, is that my understanding about the temples in Egypt is that they were designed specifically for certain deities to be placed inside them. They were designed in order to kind of generate the presence of that particular deity. If that's true, and Solomon's temple is based on their designs, then it too was designed to generate the energy of a certain deity. And, well, that would fall in line with John Michel's thinking that they used what they call the Saturn square of numbers in order to make Solomon's temple, because that would then help to generate the power of Yahweh. Are you familiar with this idea?
I'm not totally familiar with the idea, but nevertheless, I mean, Yahweh was regarded as, or the translation which is shown in the Catholic Encyclopedia for Yahweh is the Lord, and I can well see sort of where there would be this kind of connection. Yes.
Well, what really fascinates me, being involved with alchemy in my temple organization, is the belief that Solomon himself was an alchemist, and as you point out in your book, which is interesting, that Solomon seemed to be more of a title than an actual name, where perhaps his name was Jedediah, but his title was Solomon, which you point out comes from Solomon, which could mean sun and moon, which would definitely be an alchemical name, because that's what alchemy is all about, is uniting sun and moon, or uniting the polarity is water and fire together to create this alchemical force. So my question is, if that is true, then, and they're calling it Solomon's Temple, then it should be a temple of alchemy, or a temple that generates this power of alchemy, I would assume.
Well, alchemy is a fusion of things in many respects. And what I saw in my mind's eye is that it's more of what I would call this fusion of gnosis, this fusion of knowledge, as opposed to a fusion which would have been more of a metallic or physical type of capability. And again, I can only say that taking the route that I did, which was to look at it in the context of being almost like a solar observatory or a solar calendar, then, I mean, obviously you've seen a copy of the book there, and you can see that both the maths do work out when you take into account the dimensions that are mentioned in the Old Testament. And if I go back to one of the points I was making earlier, which is, why would a verbal tradition have had within them all the detail and the dimensions which are mentioned in respect of Solomon's temple, if they didn't actually have some real significance and some real meaning? Now, in my view, it would mean that in successive generations, there must have therefore been people who could build on that wisdom and know exactly how to set out or build a structure which would enable them to have the solar calendar, which in turn can be interpreted as a calendar for agricultural purposes, which greatly enabled or enhanced the ability to be able to survive. That would be incredible wisdom for people of that time, in that era, in that part of the world.
Absolutely. But to get back to what I was saying about the alchemy, I'd like to speak some more about that, because I know we have a lot of Freemasons and Templars that listen to our program, and so I'd like to focus on that some more, because are you a Freemason, by the way?
I am indeed.
Yeah, well, as you know, a lot of the rituals, they set it up to be Solomon's temple. And so, you know, that, well, because I believe it's because Solomon's temple was actually a kind of an alchemical crucible. It was designed to generate this power of alchemy. This is why setting it up for initiation is so significant. But to go back to this idea that Solomon's temple was actually built to generate this power of Yahweh, that in itself said that it would have had to have been the union, somehow the different designs incorporated into it, the numbers, whatever, were designed to unite the polarity, because that's what Yahweh is. I mean, Yod Heh Vod Heh, which is, you know, the original form of Yahweh, means male, female. And so it would have had to have been this union of the polarity, which you, if you look at some of these pictures of Solomon's Temple, there's a lot of symmetry there. There's definitely that balance of the male-female, starting with the Jachin and Boaz pillars, and then you move inside and into the Holy of Holies, where you've got the two cherubs coming together, meeting together as one. I guess what I'm interested in your work is, what other sacred symbols or sacred forms and sacred numbers have you found incorporated into Solomon's temple? Because that seems like that would help to those ideas would help to understand what its purpose originally was.
Yeah, one of the sacred symbols that I've been taking a lot of interest in, perhaps over the last 5 years or so, is a little thing called the Vesica. Now, for the benefit of your listeners, there is a geometric form which is known as Vesica Pisces. Now, Vesica Pisces is a very, very ancient image of geometry which goes way, way back, well before the Babylonians, well before the Persian Empire. But it seems to have originated probably around the joining of the Euphrates and the Tigris in what today we call Iraq. And this form of geometry is probably at least 5,000 years old. And it's created when you get two circles of exactly the same diameter, and they are drawn such that the circumference of one circle touches the center of the other. And then you end up with this rather elliptical shape, which is in the middle. And this middle area is what is known as the vesica. Now, from what I've been able to ascertain, is that this symbol became extremely, or regarded as an extremely sacred symbol, not only in the Christian churches that have been established here in Europe, but also in terms of many of the other religions that have been around the world. And the reason for this is because it has taken the shape of the female vulva. And that, of course, is not only female, but it's the source of life of just about every form of animal that there is on the planet. And we being animals, it's also the source of life for us. And therefore, in ancient times, because it was seen as being the source of life, not without people necessarily knowing all the biological details of quite how that life came to be, that it was a source of life and therefore to be revered with great ceremony and treated as a great sacred facility. And so here in Europe, you can find many, many churches, cathedrals, where this symbol is displayed. And you'll find it a lot as well in some of the jewelry and iconography that is redolent of the Vatican. Here in Europe, for example, there is a character that existed 1,200 years ago now, he was the one who really united Europe as a Christian era, and his name was Charlemagne. And having so united this whole area of Europe, or contributed to this whole area of Europe, which extends pretty well right across to the borders of Russia, right the way down to Spain and the whole of the northern and central European areas. The Vatican crowned him as King of the Romans, and he became effectively the first Holy Roman Emperor. Now, the center of his kingdom at a town called Aachen, which is in Germany. It's just across the border between Belgium, Holland, and Germany. And there is a cathedral which he had built in 800 CE. And on his tomb and on the altar, there is the shape of this this vesica. So it goes, you can give you an idea of how long sort of he's been hanging around there. Above the door of Chartres Cathedral is exactly the same emblem. And if you go to a lot of the major churches in Europe, the cathedrals, as I've said before, you can see this this image in one way or another. Now, the whole geometry of the Vesica Piscis seems to have been used by St. Bernard and the Templars in the creation of what today we call Gothic architecture. Although this term Gothic is only about 150 years old, there was no real title for it before then. And that is that by taking this process of linking together circles so that the circumference of one touches the center of the other, it creates the Gothic arch. And there are wonderful examples of this up in the what might be called the belfry of the Knights Templar Church in London. You can see it in engraved into the walls of Canterbury Cathedral and Lincoln Cathedral and Peterborough Cathedral, and gives you a really in-depth illustration of how this was used. And so it's almost as though taking this very sacred female symbol was then used as a way of almost enshrining the idea of the feminine in the great cathedrals of Europe that were subsequently built from about 1100 through to about 1350. So I think that, as far as I'm concerned, is at least an indication of the of how well thought of this particular symbol is. And, well, Mark, I hope that sort of goes some way to answer your question. Again, a long answer to a very short question.
Well, you know, what I love about the Vesica Piscis and what it seems to say to me is that when it's incorporated into a temple, then that temple was meant to be an alchemical edifice, because the Vesica Piscis unites the two circles representing the male female coming together as the one womb, and it also says to me that what you're creating there in that temple is an actual womb of the goddess, or womb of the female principle. And so when you go in, or when you leave that edifice, you're essentially being reborn.
Yes, I can understand where you're coming from on that. I have to say it's not sort of a line that I've taken. I'm trying from, if you like, an engineering perspective, sort of to look and say, how was this used, and then what's the significance behind it? And I haven't sort of bothered to. Well, no, that's the wrong term. I haven't really tried to get into any depth of it and the subject of any kind of alchemical relationship.
Well, have you studied Roslyn Chapel? I imagine you've been up there a few times.
Well, I've certainly been up there once, and I have to say I had a delight of going there. It was around about a lunchtime, and this was long, long before the Da Vinci Code sort of hit the global cinemas. And in fact, I don't think the Da Vinci Code had even been launched as a book at the time I was there. But I was there sort of roughly one lunchtime, and the tour parties had left, and I was just wandering around on my own, and a gentleman came up to me, and he said, "Look, you're looking at this very intensely." And I started asking some questions, and he turned out to be one of the key guides of the place, and gave me this wonderful sort of personal tour over it for a best part of an hour and a half. You know, I didn't need to go again.
Well, what I've noticed in the architecture, and this is something that Christopher Knight has brought out in his books, is it incorporates certain sacred symbols.
Yeah.
It incorporates the hexagon, the octagon, the six-pointed star, the eight-pointed star. Seems to also incorporate the Vesica Pisces. Some people actually believe that maybe it was built to be a scaled-down model of Solomon's Temple. What do you feel about that?
Well, I've spoken to Robert Lomas. I've not spoken to Christopher Knight, but Robert Lomas and Christopher Knight wrote the book that you're probably aware of called The Hiram Key, and they were sort of ones who put forward this idea of this very intense connection with Solomon's Temple. The trouble is that although we've got lots of images and drawings of what Solomon's Temple might have looked like, some of them going back maybe 300 years or so, the fact is that we just don't really know. Even with what I've done, as far as my book is concerned, I've tried to take it step by step based on the information that's in the Old Testament. But actually, when you look at a lot of these artistic impressions that have been developed over the last 300 years, some of them don't bear any relationship at all to what the text says in Chronicles and Kings. And equally, a number of those images are based on the kind of images that we have of Renaissance-style architecture, which was trying to recreate the kind of imagery of the Romans and the Greeks and a little bit of the Egyptians as well. So we just do not know what Solomon's Temple physically looked like. So we can't actually say, in my view, that what we have in Rosslyn is, if you like, an incomplete or a damaged edifice, as indeed Solomon's Temple would have been. It's just utterly impossible to say that. But from what I can recall from when I was up there and through reading the book, the dimensions of Rosslyn do indeed seem to fit fairly closely with those of that are mentioned in Chronicles and Kings. But there is one real difference, and that is that you don't have this process of the doorway, the main hall, and the square dimension or the cubic dimension of the Holy of Holies at the back. It's what I would call its internal arrangements. It has no bearing at all on what we're told in Chronicles and Kings Solomon's Temple would have looked like. So that leaves some very, very big doubts in my mind. But I have to say it is a quite remarkable building.
Well, I think that I've been there a number of times myself. I think it's quite fascinating when you notice that in the east direction, which would have been the entrance to Solomon's Temple, where there was the Jacob and Boaz pillars, what you've got there in Rosslyn, you've got the apprentice pillar and the master. Then if you walk through those, then you get to an area where there is the keystone, which theoretically could have been where the Holy of Holies was situated in Solomon's Temple. And it said right underneath the keystone is kind of a natural, is a form of a six-pointed star, a seal of Solomon, and underneath that supposedly is like the biggest vault they have found in the crypt, where they supposedly have stored many sacred artifacts. So it's quite fascinating that way, how there are so many correspondences between Solomon's Temple and Rosslyn Chapel.
Yeah, I don't disregard that. It's just that from my point of view, I'm trying to deal as much as I can in the things I do with hard facts, and I'm afraid on that subject, I don't have what I call hard facts that convince me. You know, I was brought up in engineering and in aerospace, and I'm afraid I was. It goes back to my upbringing, you know, that if the facts don't stand up, then well, there aren't enough facts, then you know, you can't move forward. And I'm afraid from the days of my training, that kind of situation still sits with me. So, you know, I'm going to pass very much on that.
Well, one of the beliefs, from what I understand, is that the King Hiram and Hiram Abiff, master builder of Solomon's Temple, this is what I've heard from Manly Palmer Hall and some of the other high-ranking Freemasons, that that they were members, the Hirams were members of this worldwide organization of Masons known as the Dionysian Architects. I don't know if you've heard that or not, but and so I'm wondering, you've traveled, you know, many places around the world. Does it appear to you that there was a planetary organization of Masons that kind of knew the same secrets and were using similar designs and incorporating the same dimensions?
Let's take the word Mason out of this for just a moment, right? And say and come back to this word wisdom, gnosis. And it certainly does seem that there are, as you go around the world, you can see a lot of things, a lot of very, very old things, where the same kind of thought processes, dimensions, astro-engineering have been built into some of these temples of the Far East or those associated with Buddha in India, as well as sort of those in the Middle East around Egypt and Iraq, those sorts of places, where there is this kind of wisdom that has been built into them, a common thread of wisdom, I guess is the word I want. Even down to the fact that it's one of these things I mentioned in the book of Secret of Solomon's Temple, that when I used to live in Cambridge in the UK, and up there is one of the oldest surviving Knights Templar Round churches. And I was absolutely fascinated to find that even in a church which is circular, you can still have, or appear to have, the movement of the sun being able to be used as a predictor and an indicator. And so that thread of knowledge had passed sort of from the Middle East, if you like it, into this major, what is today a major city anyway, of Cambridge. You know, at the time this church was built in this location, there was probably nothing there. So maybe a few buildings for trading, but certainly nothing of the university or anything like that was there at that time. And likewise, just when was that? About 6 months ago, I happened to be in Malaysia, and I was taking a trip to a special temple, which is built into a cave just on the outskirts of Kuala Lumpur. And I was, again, this is a very, very, very old temple and quite sacred amongst the local populace. And there are a lot of steps to climb to get into this cave. And when you get inside, there are a lot more steps that take you into different parts of the cave. And when you think in terms of Solomon's Temple, whether you've got the entrance hall, then you've got sort of the main hall itself, then the Holy of Holies at the back. First of all, the way in which this temple is made through these caves creates, first of all, that kind of significance. But it goes further than that, because when you count the number of steps, I mean, only somebody who's interested in these sorts of things like I am, you know, being fairly boring like that, I go up the steps counting the number of steps and counting how many there are in each pattern of steps. And I found that all of the sort of numbers or the sacred numbers that have been passed down the ages are all there. And here we have a society which was fairly isolated with the Malays right up until perhaps 200 or 300 years ago. Yet they are using the same sacred numbers, the same architectural features, if you like, that were being used in the Middle East, which is probably 5,000 or 6,000 miles away. So yes, I have noticed some of these threads that are passed through the various civilizations around the world. And even I might add that in the years when I lived in Australia, even amongst the Aboriginal peoples, you know, they have certain traditions built into their ways, which again reflect some of this. I'm going to come back to this term wisdom, this gnosis, which was a lot of the common threads of knowledge from that you would expect to find in Egypt turns up as part of their dreamtime stories in Australia.
Fascinating. Well, I'm particularly intrigued by your visit to the cave in near Kuala Lumpur. I imagine you're referring to the Bantu cave of Murugan.
Yes, it is.
Well, I'm intrigued because Murugan, or by another name, Sanat Kumara, is one of the patrons of our organization. We can actually trace our lineage back to the East and to his tradition, and which was very popular in ancient times in India and on Sri Lanka. That's been part of our work is to see the link to try to uncover the link that unites his tradition with the latter Templar and Freemasonic tradition. So there is definitely a strong connection there.
Yeah, I'd agree.
What inspired you to go to that cave?
Well, it just so happens that I was on a route to Australia for a personal visit, and from here to Sydney is a 22-hour jaunt in a cigar tube, and I've got to a stage where I like to take a break at part of the journey. Now I'd been both business wise and for others into Malaysia and Singapore and that part of the world quite a lot, but my wife had never been to Malaysia, so we took the opportunity of having a few days as a stopover for a bit of R&R and put your feet up by a pool bar, in the hotel, and take a bit of a rest from this 22-hour slog. And as part of the visit there, we organized a trip to go out to the cave.
Well, I certainly envy you being able to go there. That's definitely a place on my list, a pilgrimage spot that I want to hit at some point. But let's return back to Solomon's Temple now for a moment. One thing that's always interested me is the Evin Shetia, the Stona Foundation that the Dome of the Rock sits over right now. A lot of people believe that the Holy of Holies was actually placed over that rock, built over that rock. Do you have that belief?
I'm going to be very frank and say that because of the conflicts that there are in that part of the world, it's one that every time I have made arrangements to go to that part of the world and look at that, there has been a bit of a ding-dong going on between Israel and the Palestinians, and the advice we've had is don't travel. And so it's something that I've still not got to and still not really had the chance to get my mind around. But I want to be able to see the area at least, and touch the area and understand the geography of it a bit more before I would come to any sort of conclusions on that, because it comes back to what I was saying a few minutes ago. I like to try and deal with facts rather than something which is hypothetical.
Well, it seems to me that there must be a very good reason why the Holy of Holies would have been built over that rock. Perhaps it's generating some kind of special energy that would energize the Holy of Holies so that the presence of Yahweh would be more powerful within the Holy of Holies.
Well, of course, there is this tradition, which is that there is a rock there, which is possibly the remnants of a meteorite which came down several thousand years ago, and that having come down through the atmosphere, it is very hard. It is very black, and having come from another part of the universe, is therefore of a very different form and structure, and possibly quite smooth. And that it was over that rock that originally an altar had been built, where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac. Now, as a consequence of that, it became the place where the temple was built, and indeed where the Holy of Holies would have been placed. But this is all part of what I would call tradition. It's folklore. It's information passed down through the ages. And really, we have no way of knowing for certain, unless of course one could get in there and do a bit of archaeology. And I think if anybody from the rest of Western world went in there with picks and shovels, with the idea of having a bit of a poke around and a dig around, I think, first of all, the Islamic authorities would be extremely upset, and we could easily start World War III.
Yeah, I wouldn't encourage anybody to do that. That's not a really good idea.
Absolutely.
So according to tradition, then perhaps the stone foundation, the Evin Chetia, could be this massive meteorite that landed there thousands of years ago. Is that possible?
It could well be. It could well be. I gather. This is one of the reasons why I have in the past tried to plan to get there. Is that apparently for those of you who are not residents in Israel, there are apparently some visits that can be made to the Dome on the Rock, and that you can actually see part of this rock. Now, I'd dearly love to see that, but just circumstances so far have precluded from me getting there.
Well, that would certainly fall in line with my belief that Solomon's Temple was used to generate a certain alchemical force, because traditionally, within the mystery schools, for ages, they've used meteorites in order to activate the inner alchemical force within initiates. Or they've made statues. Some say that the original temple of the original statue of Artemis, Diana, in Ephesus was made out of meteorite, because it generated this kind of force that would have empowered and activated the whole entire temple. So that would certainly make sense. That's an interesting area of research, is to be able to find out the electromagnetic properties of this rock of foundation, because if its source, its content, and if it's close to that of a meteorite, well, that would certainly explain a lot as to the use of Solomon's Temple, I think.
Yeah, I mean the sort of tradition that there is here in Europe, more probably myth than tradition, is that very possibly Abraham or somebody from his tribe actually saw this meteorite come down. After all, it doesn't have to be that big, but even so, if it wasn't that big, it would have still made quite a mess in the ground. But that once it was down, it became, because it had come from the heavens, and therefore because heaven was the supposed residence of the deity, that therefore it had to have had some connection with the deity, and therefore the site became sacred, and hence the traditions of being a place of an altar, which is reflected in Genesis with Abraham's use. So yes, it would certainly have that kind of connection. In fact, I do believe, in fact, if my memory serves me correctly, there is actually quite a tradition within the Islamic world surrounding that very thought that there was something that came from heaven and hit the ground at that point, which would then fit in very, very well with what you were saying earlier.
Well, if you ever actually get inside that Dome of the Rock and you do some experimentation on that rock, I want you to promise to let me know what you find out.
I'll do that. I think there'd be an awful lot of people who would like to know.
definitely. So, what's your next step in your work, Kevin?
Well, I've just finished a book which is called Chivalry, which is looking at where orders of knighthood came from. So, needless to say, the Templars are a feature in that, but along with something like about 150 other orders of knighthood. And I'm just working now on because of my Masonic connections, I've been spending a lot of time over the years looking at the ceremonies that we have and trying to unravel the allegories that there are, which are within them. Again, I come back, I use this word that both you and I have used quite extensively over the last hour, which is this word gnosis and its translation of wisdom. And there certainly seems to be quite a lot of what I would call ancient wisdom that is embodied within these ceremonies, which nobody seems to have, I'm going to use the term, deciphered previously, or if they have, I can find no records of it. For some time, I began to think I was cuckoo, I was barking up the wrong tree, and that it was a bit of fanciful thinking. But I've also been around in management terms in areas of change and encouraging change and thinking, and I know sometimes, you know, you think a little differently and you do something a little differently and suddenly somebody pops out and says, hey, actually, you're onto a thing here. And that's almost exactly what's happened. I've been plugging away at this for a while and I've been talking about it with some of my Masonic colleagues and they're all saying, you know, this all hangs together. This is great stuff. Keep at it. So the third book is going to be based on that, but I have to say I've still got a lot of research to do.
Well, I would say also keep at it. I think that work is necessary, essential, actually. We're going to be having a conference. I'm going to be speaking at a conference in Italy about a week and a half from today. Actually, the conference is on the 17th, and we're going to be discussing exactly these things, how the root of so many of the ceremonies are based on alchemy and gnosis, and how that wisdom has been lost, and that how important it is to bring it back, to reinvest Freemasonry with that wisdom. So
I'm just going to say you just used the word lost, and in fact that's the word that I've used. I don't think it's so much lost as the fact that over the last few hundred years, particularly since the Renaissance, we've developed as a Western society, and that society has come to largely dominate the world, we've forgotten how to use it or how to interpret it, and more of late treated a lot of it as being irrelevant. And I take the view that this is information that our ancestors, going back thousands and thousands of generations, started to compile amongst themselves, largely for survival reasons, passed down to us, and we have, if you like, a duty of care to try and understand and retain that information for future generations, on the basis that it's a what's the word I want? It's a recognition of the efforts that our ancestors made. And not only that, we never know when we might want it for the future.
Well, I think that there's definitely something to that, Kevin. I would also add that one reason I believe that it has gone by the wayside, that understanding, or the Gnostic experience especially, is because, well, the Freemasonry is populated by males, and they tend to be very intellectual. And they're not so much into having the deep, mystical, emotional experience as, for example, women are. And so I think that one thing that's necessary to do is the kind of, and what is happening around the planet is a revival of this, the goddess energies, the goddess principle within all of us. We're forced to get in touch with our heart and our emotions. And now a lot of us want to have that experience. We want to have that Gnostic experience, but and we're not so much stuck in our minds or our intellects. And so, I think that now that we've gotten to this point, I think now is right for the time to reinvest Freemasonry with Gnosis and alchemy again, because, you know, we really want to have this experience now, and we're more capable of having it than we were before.
More receptive, I agree. More receptive.
Well, our time is up right now, Kevin, and I really appreciate you coming on the show, and perhaps we'll talk to you again when you do some more work on your project, and everything you're doing is important to the evolution of the secret societies now, and that's exactly what we're all about on Guardians of the Holy Grail. So thanks again for coming on today.
Well, thank you very much indeed for inviting me. I think it's been very interesting and a very robust conversation, and well, I hope both you and your listeners will have found some of the things that I've had to say as being worthwhile and maybe occasionally a bit thought-provoking as well.
Well, I'm absolutely positive that that's the case, Kevin.
Fine.
Absolutely.
Fine. Well, thank
bye-bye
you very much indeed. Yes, take care.
Okay.
Good evening or good afternoon, whichever you prefer.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks, Kevin.
Okay,
so that's our show today. I'm going to be gone. I won't be on the show next week, so we're going to actually replay the show we had with Margaret Starber. So if some of you didn't hear that show, it's a really interesting interview with Margaret, and that'll be on next week. And then I'll be back on the air in a couple weeks and talk to you about the conference and what happened. So until we meet again, always remember that the true Holy Grail is right inside of you. Bye for now.